Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 81.
Tang Monk and his disciples arrive at the Zhenhai Temple. They get a warm welcome from the monks there. But you can feel like an immediate subtle tension.
There is, isn't there?
And you might remember that woman they rescued from the Black Pine Forest earlier.
The one Wukong wasn't sure about saving.
Exactly. But Tang Monk insisted, out of his Bodhi mind, you know, his compassionate heart, well, she's still with them.
And what's immediately striking, I think, is the abbot's concern. Like, where should this woman sleep?
Yeah.
It subtly highlights the social norms, maybe a sense of, well, impropriety in that sacred space.
Right.
But Tang Monk, he's ever the diplomat, isn't he? He quickly addresses it, explains the rescue, and kind of defers to the abbot's judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So she's eventually arranged to sleep in the Heavenly King Hall behind the Bodhisattva.
Yep.
And that small detail, it really sets the scene for the sanctity of the place and these sort of subtle undercurrents around this whole journey.
The night passes pretty uneventfully, but then come morning. This is where it gets really interesting. Sun Wukong goes to wake his master, and Tang Monk is, well, he's in a really bad way.
How so?
He's got a severe headache, his eyes are swollen, his whole body aches. Just terrible.
Wow.
And Pixie, you know, always the pragmatist, always with a touch of humor.
Of course.
He immediately jumps to conclusions. Jokes that Tang Monk must have eaten too much free food and just got indigestion.
Typical Pigsy? But it does raise an interesting question, doesn't it?
It does.
Why would the revered Tang Monk, who's endured so much, you know, physical hardship, demons, everything,
right?
Why would he suddenly fall ill from what looks like a simple stomach ache?
Exactly.
Wukong, though, he quickly dismisses Pigsy's rather crude theory.
Yeah, he's not having it.
And Tang Monk himself, he blames it on getting up at midnight to relieve himself without his hat on.
Thinks he caught a chill from the wind.
Yeah, it sounds so mundane, doesn't it? Almost like an earthly complaint.
Totally.
But the source definitely hints at something far deeper than just a draft.
For sure. And he's so unwell, he can't even sit up.
Yeah.
Can't get on his horse.
Wow.
And he's genuinely worried, you know, about delaying their pilgrimage.
Ah, of course, the mission. But Wukong, he's true to his fiercely loyal nature, isn't he? Tells him not to worry. He reminds his master of that deep bond, quoting, "A day as a teacher, a lifetime as a father."
That's powerful.
It is. Emphasizing they're like sons to him. He reassures Tang Monk, look, we can wait a few days. It shows a side of Wukong that's, well, it goes beyond just fighting demons. He's truly devoted.
So 3 days pass. Yeah. Tang Monk is still very ill.
Still. Wow.
Yeah. And he even asks Wukong about the rescued woman, still showing that compassion despite his own suffering.
Even while he's down.
But Wukong just tells him, look, focus on yourself right now.
Sensible, I suppose.
Then comes this truly pivotal moment. Tang Monk asks for paper, brush, and ink.
Oh, what for?
He wants to write a letter to Emperor Taizong back in Chang, along with their official travel rescript.
Okay.
And he wants Wukong to deliver it.
Deliver it, as in go back. This sounds serious. If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is, well, it's a moment of profound despair for him.
It really feels like it.
He dictates this letter, and it's just filled with humility, sorrow, recounts all the calamities, the disasters they've faced.
Right.
And he explicitly states his illness means he can't continue. Asks the emperor to send someone else to complete the mission.
Wow. Giving up.
It's a crucial turning point. It just reveals the immense burden, the doubt he's carrying. Makes you wonder, like, how much more can this man take?
And Wukong's reaction to this letter, it's certainly spirited.
Huh. I can only imagine.
He bursts out laughing. Calls his master useless for giving up so easily.
Okay, maybe not the most sensitive reaction.
Maybe not. And then he launches into this, like, epic boast, threatening to rampage through the underworld.
Oh, here we go.
Beat up the kings of hell, judges, ghost envoys, if they even dare try and claim his master. He even invokes his whole great havoc in heaven spirit.
Classic Wukong. Such a fascinating contrast, isn't it?
It really is.
On one hand, it shows his absolute devotion, his formidable power, yes, but also his perspective. He seems to sense this isn't just a physical thing.
Right, like something else is at play.
Exactly. He senses maybe an orchestrating force behind it while Tang Monk just sees earthly suffering.
And Pigsy.
Oh, Pigsy, ever the contrarian, even suggests they should just, you know, sell a horse, pawn their stuff, buy a coffin, and call it quits.
Oh, my goodness.
It just perfectly captures the different ways they react to what looks like just a bad illness.
But here it is. The core revelation. Wukong finally spills the beans. He reveals the true, absolutely mind-boggling reason for Tang Monk's illness.
Okay, lay it on us.
Wukong explains that Tang Monk isn't just some ordinary monk.
Right.
He's actually the Golden Cicada Elder, Buddha's second disciple.
Ah, the backstory.
Who was banished to the mortal realm for, get this, disrespecting Buddha's teachings.
Okay, disrespecting teachings. Pigsy understandably questions this. Why, after all the trials, all the torments from demons?
Yeah, why more suffering?
Why would he face more suffering? But this time, through illness, it seems almost unfair.
It does.
And here is the incredibly specific, almost unbelievably detailed reason for this particular three-day illness.
Okay, I'm ready.
Wukong explains that during a lecture by the Buddha himself,
uh-huh.
the Golden Cicada Elder, Tang Monk's previous incarnation, dozed off.
He fell asleep in Buddha's lecture.
Fell asleep, slipped, and then crushed a single grain of rice with his left foot.
Wait, he crushed one grain of rice.
One single grain of rice. That seemingly tiny infraction back in the celestial realm
yeah.
resulted in this three-day illness in the mortal world.
Wow. Think about that for a second. Not some huge sin, not a betrayal. Just one grain of rice.
Yeah.
That's humbling, isn't it?
It is profoundly humbling.
It completely redefines what a mistake can even be in this universe. And Pigsy, in that moment of truly relatable humor.
What does he say?
He immediately wonders how many years of illness he would face, given his messy eating habits.
Huh, you can just picture him thinking that. But yes, it's a testament to the meticulousness of karmic accounting in this story.
It really is.
And it prompts us to consider, well, why such a seemingly disproportionate consequence for such a small oversight?
Right, it seems way out of proportion.
It speaks to the incredible precision, the strictness maybe, of karmic law in this specific universe, where even the most minute actions,
uh-huh.
particularly by those in positions of spiritual importance, carry immense weight. It's a pretty profound teaching about mindfulness, isn't it? And the interconnectedness of everything.
Definitely mindfulness. And Wukong then quotes that beautiful poem about the hard work of farmers.
Ah, yes. Hoeing rice at noon, sweat dripping onto the earth.
Who knows that the food on the plate, every grain is hard earned.
Exactly. He uses that to explain that Buddha doesn't hold such, you know, exact grudges against ordinary folks.
Okay.
But for someone like the Golden Cicada Elder, it's different.
Yeah.
He reassures his master, though, that this specific three-day penance, it's almost done. He'll be fine tomorrow.
And almost right on cue, Tang Monk says he's actually feeling a little different today.
Yeah.
And he's very thirsty.
And Wukong immediately sees this as a positive sign, a sign of recovery.
Makes sense.
It signals the completion of that specific karmic consequence. So Sun Wukong, you know, ever the go-getter, grabs a bowl, heads off to the temple kitchen. But what he finds there, it's immediately obvious something's wrong.
Yeah, definitely not normal.
What exactly does he walk into?
Well, he gets to the kitchen and it's not like busy with monks cooking or anything. Instead, he sees them and they're weaving. Silently, though.
Oh.
Their eyes are all red and swollen, clearly upset.
Yeah.
But they're not even daring to, you know, cry out loud. It's a really eerie scene.
Huh.
And Wukong, being Wukong, just completely misreads the room. He thinks they're crying because it's costing them too much to feed him and his companions.
Especially Baji, right? The long-mouthed monk.
Exactly. He's thinking of Baji's huge appetite. Wukong even sort of scolds them, calls them cowards for worrying about the food bill.
That sounds like him jumping right in. But the monks, they correct him pretty fast.
Oh, yeah. They immediately say, no, no, it's not the food. We could feed you for 100 days. That's not the issue.
So then Wukong asks, okay, if it's not the food, why the tears?
Right. And that's the moment. That's when the secret, this terrifying secret, finally comes out.
Okay, so this is where it gets serious.
This is where the tension just ramps up. Once Wukong makes it clear it's not about the food budget, the monks, almost like they're relieved to finally say it, they reveal the real reason for their terror.
Which is?
There's a demon in the temple lurking right there with them.
Oh, okay.
And for the last three nights, exactly how long the Tang monk and his group have been there, they've sent two junior monks each night to ring the bell and beat the drum. Standard temple duties.
Mm.
And they vanished. Just disappeared. The next day, all they found were their hats, their shoes, and their skeletons left in the back garden.
Skeletons. Oh, wow. So wait, 3 days, two monks a night. That's six monks.
Six monks. Gone. Eaten, presumably.
Yeah.
During the 3 days, the disciples had been staying there.
And the temple monks, they just kept quiet. Didn't tell Tang Monk.
They were too scared. They admit it. Too afraid to tell him because he was already sick. Didn't want to upset him more.
That's That's a lot to hold in. Wow.
It really is. It just shows you how utterly terrified they were.
Oh.
You know, paralyzed by fear. Even with potentially powerful help right there, they couldn't bring themselves to speak up immediately. They put the Tang monk's health first.
Okay, now Wukong hears this. Six monks eaten by a demon in the temple. His reaction is, well, it's something else, isn't it?
It really is. The text says he's surprised and happy.
Happy, not horrified.
Happy, genuinely pleased. Because for him, a demon isn't just danger, it's an opportunity. It's what he does.
Right, demon slaying is kind of his thing.
Exactly. So he immediately offers, right, I'll eradicate it. No hesitation. While everyone else is terrified, he sees a job to do, maybe even enjoys the prospect.
What do you make of that? That immediate jump to action, even pleasure?
Well, it's pure Wukong, isn't it? It shows his fundamental nature. He's a force against chaos, against evil. It's not just bragging. It's his core identity. It immediately separates him from the monks and kind of sets the stage for what's coming.
You'd think the monks would be thrilled. Great, problem solved. But no.
Not at all. They're terrified. Even more terrified, maybe. They tried to talk him out of it.
Really? Why?
They describe how powerful this demon must be. It can fly through clouds and mist, even enter the underworld. They quote this proverb at him, something like, don't trust the straightforward, beware of those who seem kind but aren't.
Hmm.
General caution. Hmm. They're really worried about what they call many inconveniences if Wukong tries and fails.
Inconveniences? That sounds like an understatement. What do they mean?
Yeah, it's a massive understatement. They lay it out pretty clear. Look, they say, we're just monks. Been here since we were kids, just praying, chanting, you know, we're not fighters. They literally say they cannot subdue tigers or dragons.
Right.
And they don't even recognize monsters. So this stranger, Wukong, comes in talking about fighting demons.
Yeah.
It's outside their whole world.
And the stakes, if he fails, are huge.
Immense.
Yeah.
They spell it out. If he messes this up, angers the demon more. Maybe over 100 monks could end up eaten. Their ancient temple, this sacred place, destroyed. And just, you know, total shame for Buddhism, for the Buddha's assembly. It's utter devastation they're picturing.
Okay, so they're basically begging him not to interfere.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And hearing all this caution, this timidity, it just makes Wukong angry.
Ah, predictable.
Yeah, he gets mad. He basically yells at them. Like, you know about the demon, but you don't know about me. And when they admit, no, they don't really know him.
He lets them know.
Oh, does he ever. He launches into this epic boast, pure Wukong theater.
Okay, give us the highlights.
Right, so he starts with, you know, I used to subdue tigers and dragons back on Flower Fruit Mountain. Standard stuff for him.
Yep.
Then he reminds them about causing chaos in heaven, stealing Laozi's immortality pills, drinking the Jade Emperor special wine, the greatest hits.
Right, the whole rebellion story.
Exactly. He talks about his fiery golden eyes that see through everything, his magic cudgel. He says no demon, big or small, can stand against him. They either run away or he catches them, destroys them. Easy.
And he throws in a proverb, too.
He does. Eight morals cross the sea, each showing their unique powers. Basically saying, okay, folks, now it's my turn to show you what I can do.
How do the monks take this?
Well, they're kind of impressed. You know, they think, okay, this guy talks a big game, but he must have some background. They're still maybe a bit skeptical, but his confidence is hard to ignore.
That someone steps in.
Yes, thankfully. A Lama monk, described as being more prudent, steps forward. He gently urges Wukong to maybe cool it for a second. Focus on the Tang monk's health first.
Sensible advice.
Very sensible. And he uses another proverb to make his point. A warrior on the battlefield is either dead or wounded. Implying, you know, don't rush into a fight unnecessarily. There are always risks.
Does Wukong actually listen?
Surprisingly, yes. This actually gets through to him. He pauses and says, you have a point, which is quite something for Wukong.
A rare moment of restraint. So he holds off on the demon hunt for now.
For a moment, yes. He takes the water back to his master and the water itself. Tang monk drinks it and feels instantly better, like half recovered on the spot, calls it sweet dew, a miracle cure.
Wow, maybe Wukong's presence helped, or maybe it was just really good water.
Who knows? But yeah, Tang monk feels much better. They have a big meal. Then, well, a big meal is prepared. Tang monk just have a little gruel.
Let me guess who eats the rest.
Zubaji, of course. Polishes off the feast. Predictable.
So Tang monk's feeling better. What happens next? Does the demon issue just fade away?
Not quite. Later that evening, Tang monk starts worrying about the delay in their journey. Wants to get back on the road. Wukong agrees. Says they can leave tomorrow.
Mm.
But he insists he has to catch that demon tonight. Before they leave.
Ah, so he didn't forget. Tang Monk must love that idea.
Not exactly. He's alarmed, warns Wukong, you know, don't do anything reckless, don't put me in danger.
And Wukong's reaction?
Annoyed. He basically says, Master, you don't get it. When I decide to act, I always win. No demon can touch me. Total confidence again.
But Tang Monk tries to reason with him on like a moral level.
Yeah, Tang Monk, being the compassionate one, pulls out another proverb, a really profound one. When it's convenient, be convenient. Where you can forgive, forgive. Why worry when a good heart is better? Why argue when tolerance is higher?
He's really trying to push for peace, maybe even sparing the demon.
It definitely seems that way. It reflects his core belief in forgiveness and avoiding conflict. But this is where Wukong plays his final card.
Which is?
Seeing his master still pushing for peace, Wukong finally tells him the whole grim truth. He says, Master, that demon, it's already eaten six of the monks here.
That changes things.
Completely. Tang Monk is taken aback. And then he quotes a proverb. When the rabbit dies, the fox grieves. Creatures mourn their own kind.
So he feels empathy. He realizes the monk's fate could be his own.
Exactly. He acknowledges, I am a monk too. This affects me, affects my kind. That shared vulnerability, that immediate threat to fellow monks, it shifts his perspective. The abstract ideal of peace hits the hard reality of immediate danger.
So the debate is over.
Pretty much. The compassion versus action conflict finds its resolution, tilted by the grim facts. Tang Monk, though clearly still reluctant, gives Wukong permission to go after the demon. He just urges him to be careful.
And Wukong's final word?
Pure confidence. He assures his master, don't worry, my hand will eliminate it as soon as it arrives. He's ready.
He tells Baji and Sha Wujing, guard the master. Then he sneaks into the Buddha hall. He lights the lamps with his true fire, no less, and starts this diversion, beating drums, ringing bells. What do you make of him deciding to be the bait himself?
It's brilliant. Classic Wukong, like you said. He's not just reacting. He's setting a trap. Transforms himself into this small, you know, unassuming young monk, 12 or 13 years old, yellow silk, white cloth, tapping a wooden fish, chanting scriptures. He's deliberately making himself look vulnerable to draw the demon out. So the tension builds. Wukong waits. Nothing happens for a bit. But then the second watch starts, the moon's rising, and things get, well, they get really interesting.
Yeah, a powerful wind just sweeps through the temple grounds. And the source material describes it so vividly. Black fog covers the sky. Sorrowful clouds darken the earth. Everything like spilled ink. I mean, it sounds really formidable. It affects everything, trees uprooted, even celestial beings like Changi and the Jade Rabbit, gods like the Nine Luminaries and Four Dragon Kings. They close their doors, shut their gates. It's huge.
That description is intense, almost apocalyptic, setting such an ominous tone. And after this huge meteorological event, what comes next? A sudden shift, right?
Yeah.
Fragrant orchids, jangling jade pendants, and then the appearance of a beautiful woman entering the Buddha Hall.
It really feels like a show of force first, maybe to disorient Wukong before the seduction part even starts. What do you think the purpose is? Such a grand, almost theatrical entrance before she even says a word.
I think it's absolutely part of her psychological game, establishing dominance, mystery, right from the start. And Wukong, still in disguise, just keeps chanting, playing the part perfectly. Then she makes her move, incredibly bold, embraces him, tries to kiss him, invites him to play in the back, asking why he's still chanting when everyone else is asleep.
And the dialogue that follows, wow, it's a masterclass in deception and wit. Wukong pretends to be innocent. Oh, I'm just chanting a vow.
Yeah.
Then she asks him directly, can you read faces? And Wukong plays along, hits her with, you seem lazy and promiscuous, chased out by your in-laws. He's pushing her buttons, testing her.
And her comeback is so sophisticated. She doesn't just deny it. She spins this elaborate story, claims unfortunate fate, married young, didn't know the bridal chamber candle. Such a poetic way to say she never, you know, consummated the marriage. Then declares it's a fated encounter and invites him to unite and become a pair of phoenixes in the back garden. Just lays it on thick.
If you connect this to the bigger picture, it's not just physical attraction she's using. It's pure psychological manipulation. She builds this narrative of victimhood, of destiny, trying to tap into his sense of duty, maybe even pity. This is a really crucial aha moment for us, isn't it? True deception isn't just about looks. It's about crafting that believable, emotionally resonant story, exploiting your target's biases or virtues. But Wukong sees right through it. He thinks, ah, those monks who met her, seduced by lust, lost their lives. Now she's trying it on me.
Oh. So he agrees to go with her. He's curious, right? Wants to see how she handles this.
Okay, so they walk off arm in arm to the back garden. And what happens next is fast. and pretty shocking, confirms everything Wukong suspected.
Exactly. The demon wastes zero time. Trips Wukong calls him darling brother as she does it, and immediately reaches for his root of passion, her physical target. It's such a direct, aggressive move. The mask slips, reveals the predator underneath that alluring disguise. But Wukong's faster, catches her hand, uses a small fall technique, like a kind of tricky judo throw, right?
Mm-hmm.
Flips her right over. And even then, she's yelling, "Darling brother, you really know how to trip your mother." I mean, audacity. She's tenacious.
Absolutely. And at this point, Wukong knows he can't play games anymore. He thinks, if I don't act now, when? First strike is strongest, second strike suffers. Mm. So he leaps up, drops the disguise, reveals his true form, and raises that golden hooped iron staff. It's on.
And the demon. She's shocked at first. This little monk is so fierce. Yeah. But then she recognizes him, Sun Wukong, Tang Sun Zhang's disciple. And suddenly, she's not afraid. That immediately makes you ask, who is this demon then? If she could face down the great sage equal to heaven, what's her actual deal?
This is where the truth behind all that deception gets revealed, and it's pretty astonishing. Despite the beauty, the sob story, the source describes her true nature. Golden nose, snow-white fur, living in underground tunnels. She's built up immense power over 300 years. And get this, she's even visited Spirit Mountain several times, ate fragrant flowers and candles. Sort of implies this false closeness to the divine, but the most startling claim she makes is that she was sent down by Buddha.
Wait, hold on. A demon sent down by Buddha? That is a massive twist. The source even says she claims to be the daughter of pagoda-bearing heavenly king and the sister of Neza. Big celestial names. But then it clarifies, doesn't it? Who would recognize her as an old rat demon?
She's not just cunning. She's incredibly audacious. Bold enough to invoke divine connections, trying to manipulate Wukong.
So, with her true nature basically outed, the battle really kicks off. She's got double-bladed swords, right?
Mm.
Creates this clanging sound. Wukong's obviously stronger, but she's quick, agile. He's having trouble pinning her down.
Yeah, the fight scene is described with really vivid imagery. Dark wind, dim moon, the temple backyard becomes a proper battlefield. It's Sun Dashing, celestial saint, versus Mao Zai Nu, queen among women, locked in this power struggle. And the imagery, Jade Tower grabs Emerald, Golden Hall shatters Mandarin ducks. It sounds like the whole temple is being torn apart by the fight. And it's clearly not just some minor skirmish. The 18 Arhats are secretly applauding. The 32 Divas are panicking. Heaven is watching this unfold.
Wukong's staff work is flawless. But the demon, she's smart. She realizes she can't win head on. So she frowns, thinks fast, pulls back. Wukong shouting, "Surrender!"
And this really shows her strategic intelligence, right? Mm-hmm. She doesn't fight a losing battle, but more than that, her escape is incredibly resourceful. She takes off her left shoe, blows a mortal ki on it, chants a spell, and turns the shoe into a copy of herself, still fighting Wukong with swords. Meanwhile, her real self turns into a clear win and just vanishes. It's a brilliant feint, not just an escape, but a diversion to buy herself crucial time.
Wow. Okay, so she escapes using this incredibly cunning trick. The immediate question then is, what does this mean for Tang Sanzang, left vulnerable back in the temple?
Well, the source calls this demon Tang Sanzang's disaster star, pretty ominous. And sure enough, immediately after escaping Wukong, she flies straight to the abbot's room, snatches Tang Sanzang up onto a cloud and whisks him away, takes him straight to her lair, Jin Kong Mountain and its bottomless cave.
And not just to eat him, right? There's a darker purpose. She wants to prepare a vegetarian wedding feast for marriage. That adds this whole other layer of danger, humiliation. It's a perversion of a sacred bond.
Wukong, he's pushed to a point of heart-burning impatience, and then something totally unexpected happens.
Mm-hmm.
He finally lands a blow, thinks he's won, right? But instead, what drops to the ground? Just a flower shoe.
A flower shoe.
Yeah. It immediately screams trickery.
And this moment, this perceived victory turning into such as a cunning deception, it's a profound blow for Wukong.
Oh, absolutely.
And for him, it triggers this explosive, almost primal response. It's quite a raw display, actually. Reminds us that even heroes with immense power aren't immune to that kind of unthinking frustration, you know, that comes with perceived failure and loss.
And that frustration is unleashed immediately. He turns around, master's completely gone.
Vanished.
And his companions, Pigsy, Baji and Sandy, Shay Sing, they're just sort of mumbling to themselves.
Yeah, not helping.
So Wukong, filled with rage, doesn't even think. He just starts beating them, yelling, "Kill you, kill you."
It's quite shocking, isn't it? Just this unchecked outburst. It really highlights the unpredictable nature of emotion, even in divine beings.
Definitely.
So Shaseng, who's usually the most composed, the most level-headed,
right?
He has to step in and try to de-escalate.
And he does it quite effectively. Shaxing kneels, makes his powerful appeal to Wukong, reminds him, you know, without them, Wukong is a single thread that can't make a line, a lone hand that can't clap.
Mm-hmm, the old proverbs.
Exactly. And he highlights the practicalities, too. Who's going to look after the baggage and the horse if they're, well, incapacitated?
Shaxing's appeal here, it isn't just about the practical stuff, though. It's like a masterclass in de-escalation and strategic collaboration.
Yeah, you're right.
He doesn't challenge Wukong's anger head on, but kind of redirects it by highlighting the bigger picture, the mission, the absolute necessity of unity.
Good point.
It underscores how real leadership often involves both strength and, you know, profound empathy.
And it works. Wukong, despite his huge powers, is described as reasonable and understands the times. So he calms down.
Thankfully.
Tells Baji and Shaxing to get up. Promises to search for the master the next day. And Baji's relieved.
You bet he is.
Promises to give it his all, declaring it's all on old Pigsy's shoulders. You can practically hear him thinking, cute, just glad it's not today.
Ah, classic Baji. Always ready to volunteer. Later.
So the trio spends this sleepless night just eager for dawn. As they prepare to leave the temple where they'd rested, the monks stop them, asking where they're going.
And what's interesting here is Wukong's surprising candor, his honesty.
Yeah.
He openly admits to the monks that he boasted about catching the monster, but instead his master is now missing. It's a rare moment of vulnerability from the great sage, you know?
That's true. The monks are, well, naturally frightened. They offer them breakfast.
Of course.
And Baji, true to form, devours it all. Even says they'll come back to play and eat again.
Priorities. Always food first for Baji.
But this is where Wukong's legendary insight really, really kicks in. He asks about the lady who stayed overnight.
Yeah.
And the monks confirm she's gone. What is it about that simple detail? How does Wukong connect the dots there, especially with his fiery eyes and golden gaze?
Well, this is where Wukong's sharp mind, often kind of overshadowed by his sheer power.
Right.
It truly shines. His fiery eyes and golden gaze, that legendary ability he has to see through all illusions, all disguises, it lets him connect these seemingly separate events.
Okay.
He instantly deduces that the woman who ate with them, the one who took the master,
yeah,
is the very same monster he fought earlier in the Black Pine Forest.
Wow, okay.
So he realizes they went the wrong way. They need to retrace their steps, go back east to the old path.
And Baji and Shaxing are just utterly amazed. They're praising him. Good, good, good. Truly rough on the outside, but detailed within.
Huh. It's a great line, isn't it?
Yeah.
A recognition of Wukong's blend of, well, brawn and brains.
Definitely. So with this newfound purpose, they immediately turn back towards the Black Pine Forest.
Right. On the move again.
They get back there quickly, and it's described so vividly, like clouds ahaze, mist stretching wide, rocks in layers, roads winding side by side.
Needs a picture.
Yeah, it's this dense, wild place,
yeah,
full of animal tracks, dangerous creatures, but still no immediate sign of the monster or their master.
And that descriptive language, it really captures the move, doesn't it? This disorienting, frustrating environment. And Wukong, well, his patience runs out again.
Oh, it does more than run out.
He decides to literally shake the answers out of the forest.
He transforms desperate into his true heavenly havoc form. Three heads and six arms holding three staves.
Whoa, full power.
And just starts violently smashing everything in the forest. Baji sees this and just says Wukong is crazy with anger.
But it's not just a tantrum, is it? It's Wukong's very blunt, very powerful method of inquiry. His furious beating isn't random. It's an act so forceful, it literally compels the local deities, the mountain god, and the earth god to show up.
He summons them with brute force and wastes no time. Wukong immediately accuses them. You're colluding with bandits and monsters. Where's my master?
Talk about an intimidating interrogation technique.
Seriously. The gods, they're trembling. Naturally, they quickly deny any collusion, but admit they know a thing or two from the night wind.
And this is it, the breakthrough?
Yep. They reveal the monster took the master 1,000 li to the south.
1,000 li? That's a huge distance.
A massive, to a place called Xiangkong Mountain, with a cave named Bottomless Cave.
Bottomless Cave. Sounds ominous.
Doesn't it? So Wukong, though he's secretly shocked by the distance, just dismisses the gods, shrinks back to his normal form, and calmly tells his brothers, okay, our master is far away.
Keeping his cool on the outside.
Pretty much. And Baji, surprisingly eager now that there's a clear direction.
Something to aim for.
Suggests they fly. And so they do. Baji takes off first on a wild wind.
Always the showman, in his own way.
Followed by Sha Sang on his cloud with the horse and Wukong with his somersault cloud heading straight south.
And this is a great moment showing each disciple's unique abilities, isn't it?
Yeah.
It highlights the different strengths within the team. Baji's surprising speed bursts, Sha Sing's steady cloud riding.
Yeah.
Even the white dragon horse. Remember, he's a former dragon prince.
Right.
He just treads the wind and mist effortlessly with the baggage. Pretty cool image.
It really is. So before long, they encounter this massive mountain blocking their path. It has to be Shang Kong Mountain.
The destination.
A place of really imposing beauty, but you can just feel the danger. Peaks touching the blue sky, summits reaching the green firmament.
Wow.
It's described with these vivid, almost paradoxical details, you know. Innumerable varied trees and chattering birds on one side, but unmelted snow and stubborn ice on the other. You've got tigers and leopards moving in formation, deer and stags traveling in herds. It's both pristine and profoundly wild.
That duality, it raises the crucial question, doesn't it? What kind of challenges lie ahead in a place that's so visually striking, but also so treacherous?
Exactly.
And Baji, despite his usual complaints, he instinctively gets it. He just notes, this mountain is so dangerous, there must be evil. It's a gut feeling.
And Wukong confirms that instinct immediately. High mountains always have monsters. How can steep ridges be without spirits? Standard operating procedure for them, basically.
Pretty much their life now, yeah.
So he devises a plan. Sha Sing stays with him while Baji gets sent ahead to scout the mountain pass.
Baji's turn again.
Find a good path, locate the cave entrance. And Baji, ever the reluctant hero, grumbles, old Pigsy's unlucky, always first to take the hit.
Classic Baji. You knew that was coming. Always promising the world until the world involves actual effort first.
But Wukong quickly reminds him of his earlier promise. It's all on old Pigsy's shoulders.
Uh-huh. Gotcha.
So Baji, dropping his rake, heads off to scout, leaving us hanging, wondering what he'll discover next.
Right at the entrance to danger.